The Last of the Barrow Kings.
The rusted crown upon the arms of House Dustin derives from their claim that they are themselves descended from the first king and the Barrow Kings who ruled after him. The old tales recorded in Kennett's Passages of the Dead claim that a curse was placed on the great barrow that would allow no living man to rival the first king. This curse made these pretenders to the title grow corpse-like in their appearance, as it sucked away their vitality and life. This is no more than legend, to be sure, but that the Dustins share blood and descent from the Barrow Kings of old seems sure enough. As knighthood is rare in the north, the knightly tourney and its pageantry and chivalry are as rare as hen's teeth beyond the neck. Northmen fight a horse with war lances, but seldom tilt for sport, preferring melees that are only just this side of battles. There are accounts of contests that have lasted half a day, and left fields trampled and villages half torn down. Serious injuries are common in such a melee, and deaths are not unheard of. In the great melee at Last Hearth, in 170 AC, it is said that no fewer than 18 men died, and half again that number were sorely maimed before the day was done.
The men of the north are descendants of the first men, their blood only slowly mingling with that of the Andals, who overwhelm the kingdoms to the south. The original language of the first men, known as the Old Tongue, has come to be spoken only by the wildlings beyond the wall, and many other aspects of their culture have faded away, such as the grislier aspects of their worship, when criminals and traitors were killed and their bodies and entrails hung from the branches of weirwoods. But the Northmen still retain something of the old ways in their customs and their manner. Their life is harder, and so they are hardened by it. And the pleasures that in the south are considered noble are thought childish and less worthy than the hunting and brawling that the Northmen love best. Even their house names mark them out, for the first men bore names that were short and blunt and to the point, names like Stark, Wall, Umber, and Stout, all stem from the days when the Andals had no influence on the North. One notable custom that the Northmen hold dearer than any other is guest right, the tradition of hospitality by which a man may offer no harm to a guest beneath his roof, nor a guest to his host. The Andals held to something like it as well, but it looms less large in southern minds. In his text, Justice and Injustice in the North, Judgments of Three Stark Lords, Maester Egbert notes that crimes in the North in which guest right was violated were rare, but were invariably treated as harshly as the direst of treasons. Only kinslaying is deemed as sinful as the violations of these laws of hospitality.
In the north, they tell the tale of the rat cook, who served an Andal king, identified by some as King Tywel II of the Rock, and by others as King Oswald I of the Vale and Mountain, the flesh of the king's own son baked into a pie. For this, he was punished by being turned into a monstrous rat that ate its own young. Yet, the punishment was incurred not for killing the king's son, or for feeding him to the king, but for the breaking of guest right.
The Kings of Winter. Song and story tell us that the Starks of Winterfell have ruled large portions of the lands beyond the neck for 8,000 years, styling themselves the Kings of Winter, the more ancient usage, and, in more recent centuries, the Kings in the North. Their rule was not an uncontested one. Many were the wars in which the Starks expanded their rule, or were forced to win back lands that rebels had carved away. The Kings of Winter were hard men in hard times. Ancient ballads, amongst the oldest to be found in the archives of the Citadel of Old Town, tell of how one King of Winter drove the giants from the north, whilst another felled the skin-changer, Gavin Greywolf, and his kin, in the savage war of the wolves. But we have only the word of singers that such kings and such battles ever existed. More historical proof exists for the war between the kings of winter and the Barrow kings to their south, who style themselves the kings of the first men and claim supremacy over all first men everywhere, even the Starks themselves. Runic records suggest that their struggle, dubbed the Thousand Years' War by the singers, was actually a series of wars that lasted closer to 200 years than 1,000, ending when the last Barrow king bent his knee to the King of Winter and gave him the hand of his daughter in marriage. Even this did not give Winterfall dominion over all the North. Many other petty kings remained, ruling over realms great and small, and it would require thousands of years and many more wars before the last of them was conquered. Yet one by one the Starks subdued them all, and during these struggles many proud houses and ancient lines were extinguished forever. Amongst the houses reduced from royals to vassals, we can count the Flints of Breakstone Hill, the Slates of Blackpool, the Umbers of Last Hearth, the Lucks of Oldcastle, the Glovers of Deepwood Mott, the Fishers of the Stony Shore, the Riders of the Rills, and perhaps even the Blackwoods of Raventree, whose own family tradition insists they once ruled most of the Wolfswood before being driven from their lands by the Kings of Winter. Certain runic records support this claim, if Maester Barnaby's translations can be trusted. Chronicles found in the archives of the Night's Watch at the Night Fort, before it was abandoned, speak of the war for Sea Dragon Point, wherein the Starks brought down the Warg King and his inhuman allies, the Children of the Forest. When the Warg King's last redoubt fell, his sons were put to the sword, along with his beasts and green seers, whilst his daughters were taken as prizes by their conquerors. House Greenwood, House Towers, House Amber, and House Frost met similar ends, together with a score of lesser houses and petty kings, whose very names are lost to history. Yet the bitterest foes of Winterfell were undoubtedly the Red Kings of the Dreadfort, those grim lords of House Bolton, whose domains of old stretched from the last river to the White Knife and as far south as the Sheepshead Hills. The enmity between the Starks and Boltons went back to the Long Night itself, it is claimed. The wars between these two ancient families were legion, and not all ended in victory for House Stark. King Royce Bolton, second of his name, is said to have taken and burned Winterfell itself. His namesake and descendant, Royce the Fourth, remembered by history as Royce Redarm, for his habit of plunging his arm into the bellies of captain foes to pull out their entrails with his bare hand, did the same 3 centuries later. Other Red Kings were reputed to wear cloaks made from the skins of Stark princes they had captured and flayed. Yet in the end, even the Dreadfort fell before the might of Winterfell, and the last Red King known to history as Rhaegar the Huntsman swore fealty to the King of Winter and sent his sons to Winterfell as hostages, even as the first Andals were crossing the narrow sea in their longships. After the defeat of the Boltons, the last of their northern rivals, the greatest threats to the dominion of House Stark, came by sea. The northern boundary of the Stark domains was protected by the Wall and the men of the Night's Watch, whilst to the south the only way through the swamps of the Neck passed below the ruined towers and sinking walls of the great fortress called Moat Cailin. Even when the Marsh Kings held the moat, their Crannog men stood staunch against any invaders from the south, allying with the Barrow Kings, Red Kings, and Kings of Winter, as need be to turn back any southern lord who sought to attack the north. And once King Rickard Stark added the Neck to his domain, Moat Cailin proved even more imposing. A bulwark against the powers of the South. Few sought to push past it, and the histories say that none ever succeeded. The North's long, ragged coastlines, both to the east and the west, remained vulnerable, however. It would be there where the rule of Winterfell would be most oft-threatened, by Ironborn in the west and Andals in the east. Crossing the narrow sea in their hundreds and thousands, the longships of the Andals made landings in the north just as they did to the south. But wherever they came ashore, the Starks and their bannermen fell upon them and drove them back into the sea. King Theon Stark, known to history as the Hungry Wolf, turned back the greatest of these threats, making common cause with the Boltons to smash the Andal warlord, Argus Sevenstar, at the Battle of the Weeping Water. In the aftermath of his victory, King Theon raised his own fleet and crossed the narrow sea to the shores of Andalus, with Argus's corpse lashed to the prow of his flagship. There, it is said, he took a bloody vengeance, burning a score of villages, capturing three tower houses and a fortified sept, and putting hundreds to the sword. The heads of the slain the Hungry Wolf claimed as prizes, carrying them back to Westeros and planting them on spikes along his own coasts as a warning to other would-be conquerors. Later in his blood-drenched reign, he himself conquered the Three Sisters and landed an army on the Fingers, but these conquests did not long endure. King Theon also fought the Ironborn in the west, driving them from Cape Kraken and Bear Island, put down a rebellion in the Rills, and joined the Night's Watch in an incursion beyond the wall that broke the power of the wildlings for a generation. Even before the coming of the Andals, the Wolf's Den had been raised by King John Stark, built to defend the mouth of the White Knife against raiders and slavers from across the narrow sea. Some scholars suggest these were early Andal incursions, whilst others argue they were the forebears of the men of Ib, or even slavers out of Valyria and Valantis. Held for centuries by a succession of houses, including the Greystarks, an offshoot of House Stark itself, as well as Flints, Slates, Longs, Holts, Locks, and Ashwoods, the ancient fortress would be the focus of a succession of conflicts. During the wars between Winterfell and the Andal kings of Mountain and Vale, the old falcon, Osgood Aaron, laid siege to the Wolf's Den. His son, King Oswin the Talon, captured it and put it to the torch. Later it fell under attack from the pirate lords of the Three Sisters and slavers out of the Stepstones. It was not until some thousand years before the conquest when the fugitive Mandalays came to the north and swore their oaths at the Wolf's Den, that the problem of the defense of the White Knife, the river that provides access into the very heart of the north, was resolved with the creation of White Harbor. The west coast of the north has also oft been beset by reavers, and several of the Hungry Wolf's wars were forced upon him when longships out of Great Wick, Old Wick, Pike, and Orkmont descended upon his western coasts, beneath the banners of Harrig Hor, King of the Iron Islands. For a time the stony shore did fealty to Harrig and his iron men. Swathes of the Wolf's Wood were nothing but ashes, and Bear Island was a base for reaving, ruled by Harrig's black-hearted son, Ravus the Raper. Though Theon Stark slew Ravus with his own hand and expelled the iron men from his shores, they would return under Harrig's grandson, Eric the Eagle, and again under the old Kraken, Loren Greyjoy, who retook both Bear Island and Cape Kraken. King Roderick Stark reclaimed the first of those after the old Kraken's death, whilst his sons and grandsons battled for the latter. The wars between the North and the Ironborn would continue thereafter, but less decisively.
Until King's Landing rose beside the Blackwater, White Harbor was the newest city in the Seven Kingdoms. Built with the wealth that the Manderleys had brought with them from the Reach, after having been driven into exile by Lord Lorimer Peake at the behest of King Percion III, Gardener, who feared their swelling power in the Reach, White Harbour has more in common with the fine castles and towers of the Reach than with the castles of the North. It is said that the new keep was built to reflect the castle of Dunstanbury, which the Manderleys had lost in their exile.
The Mountain Clans. The clans of the Northern Mountains are especially famed for their adherence to the laws of hospitality, and the petty lords who rule these clans often vie with one another to be the most open-handed of hosts. These clans, located largely in the mountainous regions beyond the Wolfswood, in the high valleys and meadows, and along the Bay of Ice and certain rivers of the north, owe their allegiance to the Starks, but their disputes have often created difficulties for the lords of Winterfell and the kings of Winter before them, forcing them to send men into the mountains to quell the bloodshed, commemorated in such songs as Black Pines and Wolves in the Hills, or to summon the chiefs to Winterfell to argue their cases. The mightiest of the northern clans are the Wolves, the fisher folk who dwell along the shores of the Bay of Ice. Their hatred of the wildlings is matched only by their hatred of the men of the Iron Islands, who have often raided along the shore of the bay, burning their halls, carrying off their crops, and taking their wives and daughters as thralls and salt wives. Large tracts of the Stony Shore, Bear Island, Sea Dragon Point, and Cape Kraken have all been held by Iron Men at times. Indeed, Cape Kraken, closest to the Iron Islands, has changed hands so many times that many maesters believe its populace to be closer in blood to the Iron Men than to Northmen.
The histories of the North claim that Roderick Stark won Bear Island back from the Ironborn in a wrestling match, and perhaps there is truth to this tale. The kings of the Iron Isles were often moved to prove their prowess and their right to wear the driftwood crown with feats of strength. More sober scholars call this into question, suggesting that if there was wrestling, it was with words.
The Stoneborn of Skagus. Despite centuries of feuds, the mountain clans have traditionally remained loyal to the Starks through war and peace. The same cannot be said of the savage denizens of Skagos, the mountainous island east of the Bay of Seals. The Skagussi, who reside there, are little regarded by the other Northmen, who consider them no better than wildlings, and name them Skags. The Skagussi call themselves the Stoneborn, referring to the fact that Skagos means stone in the old tongue. A huge, hairy, foul-smelling folk, some maesters believe the Skagussi to have a strong admixture of Ebonese blood. Others suggest they may be descended from giants, clad in skins and furs and untanned hides, and said to ride on unicorns. The Skagussi are the subject of many a dark rumor. It is claimed that they still offer human sacrifice to their weirwoods, lure passing ships to destruction with false lights, and feed upon the flesh of men during winter. Like as not, the Skagussi surely did once practice cannibalism, though whether this custom still lingers to this day is a matter of much dispute. The Edge of the World, a collection of tales and legends compiled by Maester Balder, who served the commander of East Watch by the Sea during the 60-year rule of Lord Commander Osric Stark, is our chief source for much of what we know of the Skagussi, including the Feast of Skene, wherein a Skagussi war fleet descended upon the smaller nearby isle of Skene, raping and carrying off the Skanish women, while slaying the Skanish men and consuming their flesh in a feast that lasted a fortnight. Whether this be true or not, Skene remains uninhabited to this day, though tumbled stones and overgrown foundations testify that men did once dwell amongst its windswept hills and stony shores. Though rarely seen off their island, the Stoneborn were once accustomed to crossing the Bay of Seals to trade, or more often, raid, until King Brandon Stark, ninth of his name, broke their power once and for all, destroyed their ships, and forbade them the sea. For most of recorded history, they have remained an isolated, backward, savage folk, as like to murder those who land upon their isle as to trade with them. When they do consent to trade, the Skagossi offer pelts, obsidian blades and arrowheads, and unicorn horns for goods they desire.
The unicorns of Skagos were once scoffed at by maesters at the citadel. The occasional unicorn horn offered by disreputable merchants has never been more than the horn of a kind of whale hunted by the whalers of Ib. However, horns of quite a different kind, reputed to be from Skagos, have been seen by the maesters at Eastwatch upon occasion. It is also said that those seafarers brave enough to trade on Skagos have glimpsed the stone-born lords riding great shaggy horned beasts, monstrous mounts so sure-footed they have been known to climb the sides of mountains. A living example of such a creature, or even a skeleton, has long been sought for study, but none has ever been brought to Old Town.
Some Skagossi have served in the Night's Watch as well. More than 1,000 years ago, a Krull, a member of a clan that passes for nobility on Skagos, was even Lord Commander for a time, and the annals of the Black Centaur speak of a Stain, a member of another Skagossi family, who rose to become First Ranger, but died shortly thereafter. Skagos has often been a source of trouble for the Starks, both as kings, when they sought to conquer it, and as lords when they fought to keep its fealty. Indeed, as recently as the reign of King Daeron the Second Targaryen, Daeron the Good, the Isle rose up against the Lord of Winterfell, a rebellion that lasted years and claimed the lives of thousands of others, including that of Barthogan Stark, Lord of Winterfell, called Barth Blacksword, before finally being put down. The Crannog Men of the Neck. Last, and some might say the least, of the peoples of the North are the swamp dwellers of the Neck, known as Crannog Men for the floating islands on which they raise their halls and hovels. A small, sly people, some say they are small in stature because they intermarried with the children of the forest, but more likely it results from inadequate nourishment, for grains do not flourish amidst the fens and swamps and salt marshes of the Neck, and the Crannog Men subsist largely upon a diet of fish, frogs, and lizards. They are quite secretive, preferring to keep to themselves. South of the Neck, the river folk whose lands adjoin their own say that the Crannog Men breathe water, have webbed hands and feet like frogs, and use poisons on their frog spears and their arrows. That last, it must be said, is true enough. Many a merchant has brought rare herbs and plants with many queer properties to the citadel, for the maester seeks such things out to better understand their properties and their value. But of the rest there is no truth in it. Crannog Men are men, albeit smaller than most, even if they live in a fashion unique in the Seven Kingdoms. Long ago, the histories claim, the Crannog Men were ruled by the Marsh Kings. Singers tell of them riding on lizard lions and using great frog spears like lances, but that is clearly fancy. Were these Marsh Kings even truly kings, as we understand it? Archmaester Iron writes that the Crannog Men saw their kings as the first among equals, who were often thought to be touched by the old gods, a fact that was said to show itself in eyes of strange hues, or even in speaking with animals, as the children are said to have done. Whatever the truth, the last man to be called Marsh King was killed by King Rickard Stark, sometimes called the Laughing Wolf in the North for his good nature, who took the man's daughter to wife, whereupon the Crannog Men bent their knees and accepted the dominion of Winterfell. In the centuries since, the Crannog men have become stout allies of the Starks, under the leadership of the Reeds of Greywater Watch. The Lords of Winterfell. After the conquest and the unification of the Seven Kingdoms, the Starks became Wardens of the North rather than Kings, swearing their fealty to the Iron Throne, yet remained supreme within their own domains in all but name. Though Torrhen Stark had given up the ancient crown of the Kings of Winter, his sons were less glad of the Targaryen yoke, and some among them entertained talk of rebelling and of raising the Stark banner, whether Lord Torrhen consented or not. Later still it was said that the Starks were bitter at the old King and Queen Alysanne for having forced them to carve away the new gift and give it to the Night's Watch. This may be one reason why Lord Ellard Stark sided with Corlys Velaryon and Princess Rhaenys at the Great Council of 101 AC.
Whether anti-Targaryen feelings were made worse by Queen Rhaenys Targaryen's efforts to knit together the new single realm with marriages between the great houses is left to the reader to consider. That Torrhen Stark's daughter was wed to the young and ill-fated Lord of the Vale is well known. It was one of the many peace-binding marriages forged by Rhaenys. But there are letters preserved at the Citadel suggesting that Stark accepted these arrangements only after much protest, and that the bride's brothers refused to attend the wedding entirely. Though in these days it is said that Lord Ellard Stark was glad to aid the Night's Watch with the gift, and took little convincing, the truth is otherwise. Letters from Lord Stark's brother to the Citadel, asking the Maesters to provide precedence against the forced donation of property, made it plain that the Starks were not eager to do as King Jaehaerys bid. It may be that the Starks feared that, under the control of the Castle Black, the new gift would inevitably decline, for the Night's Watch would always look northward and never give much thought to their new tenants to the south. And, as it happens, that soon came to pass, and the new gift is now said to be largely unpopulated, thanks to the decline of the watch and the rising toll taken by raiders from beyond the wall.
We have earlier discussed House Stark's role in the Dance of the Dragons. Let it be added that Lord Craegan Stark reaped many rewards for his loyal support of King Aegon III. Even if it was not a royal princess marrying into his family, as had been agreed in the Pact of Ice and Fire made when the doomed prince Jaehaerys Velaryon had flown to Winterfell upon his dragon. After the Dance of the Dragons, the Starks were more overtly loyal to the Targaryens than previously. Indeed, Lord Craegan Stark's son and heir fought beneath a Targaryen banner when the young dragon sought to conquer Dorne. Rickon Stark fought bravely, his deeds sometimes reported by King Daeron in his Conquest of Dorne, and Rickon's death outside of Sunspear in one of the final battles was lamented in the North for years to come because of the troubles that dogged the reigns of his half-brothers. In the decades that followed, the North saw the Starks dealing with a rebellion of Skaegos, a renewed onslaught of reaving by the Ironborn under Dagon Greyjoy, and a wildling invasion led by Raymond Redbeard, the King Beyond the Wall, in 226 AC. In each of these, Starks died. Yet the house continued with its fortunes mostly unchanged, likely because of the firm resolve of most lords of Winterfell not to become embroiled in the intrigues of the Southern Court. When the Stark line was nearly obliterated by Mad King Aerys after Rhaegar's abduction of Lyanna, some misguided men laid the blame at the feet of the late Lord Rickard, whose alliances by blood and friendship tied the great houses together and ensured they would act together in response to the Mad King's crimes. Winterfell. The greatest castle of the North is Winterfell, the seat of the Starks since the Dawn Age. Legend says that Brandon the Builder raised Winterfell after the generation-long winter known as the Long Night, to become the stronghold of his descendants, the Kings of Winter. As Brandon the Builder is connected with an improbable number of great works, Storm's End and The Wall, to name but two prominent examples, over a span of numerous lifetimes, the tales have likely turned some ancient king or a number of different kings of House Stark, for there have been many Brandons in the long reign of that family, into something more legendary. The castle itself is peculiar in that the Starks did not level the ground when laying down the foundations and walls of the castle. Very likely this reveals that the castle was built in pieces over the years, rather than being planned as a single structure. Some scholars suspect it was once a complex of linked ring forts, though the centuries have eradicated almost all evidence of this.
The outer walls of Winterfell were raised during the last two decades of the reign of King Edric Snowbeard. Though Edric is famed for a reign that lasted nearly a century, his rule in his dotage was increasingly erratic. Seeing this, many different factions tried to seize control of his faltering realm. The most obvious threats were from his own numerous and fractious descendants. But others took their chances as well, including Iron Men, slavers from across the Narrow Sea, wildlings, and northern rivals such as the Boltons.
The inner walls, which were once the only defensive walls, are estimated to be some 2,000 years old, and perhaps some sections are older still. In later years, a defensive moat was dug around them. Then a second wall was raised beyond the moat, giving the castle a formidable defense. The inner walls stand 100 feet high, the outer walls 80. Any attacker who succeeded in capturing the outer wall would still find defenders on the inner walls loosing spears and stones and arrows down at him. Within its walls, the castle sprawls across several acres of land, encompassing many freestanding buildings. The oldest of these, a long-abandoned tower, round and squat and covered with gargoyles, has become known as the First Keep. Some take this to mean that it was built by the First Men, but Maester Kennet has definitively proved that it could not have existed before the arrival of the Andals, since the First Men and the early Andals raised square towers and keeps. Round towers came sometime later.
We can dismiss Mushroom's claim in his testimony that the dragon Vermax left a clutch of eggs somewhere in the depths of Winterfell's crypts, where the waters of the hot springs run close to the walls, while his rider treated with Kragan Stark at the start of the Dance of the Dragons. As Archmaester Gildane notes in his fragmentary history, there is no record that Vermax ever laid so much as a single egg, suggesting the dragon was male. The belief that dragons could change sex at need is erroneous, according to Maester Anson's Truth, rooted in a misunderstanding of the esoteric metaphor that Barth preferred when discussing the higher mysteries.
To the trained eye, the architecture of Winterfell is an amalgam of many different eras, and its vastness not only encompasses buildings but open areas as well. In fact, 3 acres alone are given over to an ancient godswood, where legend tells us Brandon the Builder once prayed to his gods. Whether this is true or not, the antiquity of the grove cannot be contested, and the godswood no doubt benefits from the hot springs that are contained within it, protecting the trees from the worst of the winter's chill. Indeed, the presence of the hot springs, which pepper the land around Winterfell, may be the chief reason why the First Men initially settled there. One can easily imagine the value that a ready source of water, and hot water at that, would have had in the depths of a northern winter. In recent centuries, the Starks have raised structures that have made direct use of these springs for the purpose of heating their dwellings.
Hot springs, such as the one beneath Winterfell, have been shown to be heated by the furnaces of the world, the same fires that made the 14 flames or the smoking mountain of Dragonstone. Yet the small folk of Winterfell and the Winter Town have been known to claim that the springs are heated by the breath of a dragon that sleeps beneath the castle. This is even more foolish than Mushroom's claims, and need not be given any consideration.
The Wall and Beyond. The Night's Watch. Unique in the Seven Kingdoms is the Night's Watch, the sworn brotherhood that has defended the wall over centuries and millennia, born in the aftermath of the Long Night, the generation-long winter that brought the Others down on the realms of men and nearly put an end to them. The history of the Night's Watch is a long one. Tales still tell of the Black Knights of the Wall and their noble calling, but the age of heroes is long done, and the Others have not shown themselves in thousands of years, if indeed they ever existed. And so year by year, the Watch has dwindled. Their own records prove that this decline has been in progress even before the age of Aegon the Conqueror and his sisters. Though the Black Brothers of the Watch still guard the realms of men as nobly as they may, the threats they face no longer come from Others, wights, giants, green seers, wargs, skin changers, and other monsters from children's tales and legend, but rather barbaric wildlings armed with stone axes and clubs, savages to be sure, but only men, and no match for disciplined warriors. It was not always so. Whether the legends are true or not, it is plain that the first men and the children of the forest, and even the giants, if we take the word of the singers, feared something enough that it drove them to begin raising the wall. And this great construction, simple as it is justly accounted among the wonders of the world. It may be that its earliest foundations were of stone. The maesters differ in this. But now all that can be seen for a distance of 100 leagues is ice. Nearby lakes provided the material, which the first men cut into huge blocks and hauled upon sledges to the wall and worked into place one by one. Now thousands of years later, the wall stands more than 700 feet tall at its highest point, though its height varies considerably over the 100 leagues of its length, as it follows the contours of the land.
Legend has it that the giants helped raise the wall, using their great strength to wrestle the blocks of ice into place. There may be some truth to this, though the stories make the giants out to be far larger and more powerful than they truly were. These same legends also say that the children of the forest, who did not themselves build walls of either ice or stone, would contribute their magic to the construction. But the legends, as always, are of dubious value.
Beneath the shadow of that wall of ice, the Night's Watch raise 19 strongholds, though they are unlike any other castles in the Seven Kingdoms, for they have no curtain walls or other defensive fortifications to protect them, the wall itself being more than ample against any threat coming from the north, and the Watch insists it has no foes to the south. The greatest and oldest of these is the Night Fort, which has been abandoned for the past 200 years. As the Watch shrunk, its size made it too large and too costly to maintain. Maesters who served at the Night Fort whilst it was still in use made it plain that the castle had been expanded upon many times over the centuries, and that little remained of its original structure save for some of the deepest vaults chiseled out of the rock beneath the castle's feet. Yet over the thousands of years of its existence as the chief seat of the Watch, the Night Fort has accrued many legends of its own, some of which have been recounted in Archmaester Harmoon's Watchers on the Wall. The oldest of these tales concern the legendary Night's King, the 13th Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, who was alleged to have bedded a sorceress pale as a corpse and declared himself a king. For 13 years, the Night's King and his corpse queen ruled together, before King of Winter, Brandon the Breaker, in a lies that is said with the king beyond the wall, Joramun, brought them down. Thereafter he obliterated the Night's King's very name from memory. In the Citadel, the Archmaesters largely dismissed these tales, though some allow there may have been a Lord Commander who attempted to carve out a kingdom for himself in the earliest days of the Watch. Some suggest that perhaps the Corpse Queen was a woman of the Barrowlands, a daughter of the Barrow King, who was then a power in his own right, and oft associated with graves. The Night's King has been said to have been variously a Bolton, a Woodfoot, an Umber, a Flint, a Nurry, or even a Stark, depending on where the tale is told. Like all tales, it takes on the attributes that make it most appealing to those who tell it. The Night's Watch, which might well be called the first militant order of the Seven Kingdoms, for the first duty of all its members is to defend the wall, and all are trained at arms to this end, has divided its sworn brothers into three groups. One, the stewards who supply the watch with food, clothing, and all the other things they need to make war. Two, the builders who tend to the wall and the castles. Three, the rangers who venture into the wilds beyond to make war upon the wildlings. Leading them are the senior officers of the watch, the chief of whom is the Lord Commander. He himself is appointed by election. The men of the watch, each and every one, from the unlettered former poachers to the scions of the great houses, will cast a vote for the man he believes should lead them. Once one man has the greater part of the votes, he will lead the watch until his death. It is a custom that has largely served the watch well, and efforts to subvert it, as when Lord Commander Runcel Hightower attempted to leave the watch to his bastard son some 500 years ago, have never lasted. Sadly, the most important truth about the Night's Watch today is its decline. It may once have served a great purpose, but if the others ever existed, they have not been seen in thousands of years, and are of no threat to men. It is the wildlings beyond the wall who are the danger the Night's Watch now face. Yet only when there are kings beyond the wall have the wildlings ever truly presented a threat to the realms of men. The vast expense in sustaining the wall and the men who man it has become increasingly intolerable. Only 3 of the castles of the Night's Watch are now manned, and the order is a tenth of the size it was when Aegon and his sisters landed. Yet even at this size, the watch remains a burden. Some argue that the wall serves as a useful way of ridding the realm of murderers, rapers, poachers and their ilk, whilst others question the wisdom of putting weapons in the hands of such and training them in the arts of war. Wildling raids may rightly be considered more of a nuisance than a menace. Many wise men suggest that they might be better dealt with by allowing the lords of the north to extend their rule beyond the wall, so they can drive the wildlings back. Only the fact that the Northmen themselves greatly honour the watch has kept it functioning, and a great part of the food that keeps the Black Brothers of Castle Black, the Shadow Tower, and East Watch by the Sea from starving comes not from the gift, but from the yearly gifts these northern lords deliver to the wall in token of their support.
Castles of the Night's Watch. Active. The Shadow Tower. Castle Black, now the seat of the Lord Commander of the Watch. East Watch by the Sea. Abandoned. West Watch by the Bridge. Sentinel Stand. Grey Guard. Stone Door. Hoarfrost Hill. Ice Mark. The Knight Fort. Deep Lake. Queensgate, which was once named Snowgate before being renamed in honor of Good Queen Alysan. Oakenshield. Woods Watch by the Pool. Sable Hall. Rhymegate. Long Barrow. Torches. Green Guard.
The Wildlings. In the lands beyond the wall lived the diverse people, all descended from the first men, that we of the more civilized South name wildlings. This is not a term they use themselves. The largest and most numerous of the various peoples beyond the wall name themselves the free folk, in their belief that their savage customs allow them lives of greater freedom than the kneelers of the South. And it is true that they live with neither lords nor kings, and need bow to neither man nor priest, regardless of their birth or blood or station. But they also live meanly, and are not free from starvation, from the extremities of cold, from barbaric warfare, or from the depredations of their own kind. The lawlessness beyond the wall is nothing to envy, as any man who has seen wildlings can attest. And many have so attested in a number of works based on the accounts from the rangers of the Night's Watch. Their pride in their poverty, in their stone axes and wicker wood shields, and in their flea-infested pelts, is part of the reason they are set apart from the people in the Seven Kingdoms.
The wildling raiders trouble the realm largely for iron and steel, things they lack the skill to make themselves. Many raiders are armed with weapons of wood and stone, even of horn, in some cases. Some carry bronze axes and knives, but even these are considered valuable. The famous war leaders amongst them often sport stolen steel, sometimes taken from rangers of the watch whom they have killed.
The countless tribes and clans of the free folk remain worshippers of the old gods of the first men and children of the forest, the gods of the weirwood trees. Some accounts say that there are those who worship different gods, dark gods beneath the ground in the frost fangs, gods of snow and ice on the frozen shore, or crab gods at Starl's Point. But such has never been reliably confirmed. Rangers of the Night's Watch speak of still stranger peoples who dwell in the more distant corners of the lands beyond the wall, of bronze-clad warriors from a hidden vale far to the north, and hornfoots who go barefoot even over ice and snow. We know of the wild people of the frozen shore who live in huts of ice and ride sleds pulled by hounds. There are half a dozen tribes who make their homes in caverns, and rumors tell of cannibals in the upper reaches of the icy rivers beyond the wall. But few rangers have penetrated more than half a hundred leagues into the haunted forest, and doubtless there are more kinds of wildlings than even they can imagine. The threat posed to the realm by these savage peoples can safely be discounted, save for the times, once in a great while, when they united beneath the leadership of a king beyond the wall. Though many wildling raiders and war chiefs have aspired to this title, few have ever achieved it. None of the wildlings who have risen up to become king beyond the wall have done aught to build a true kingdom or care for their people. In truth, such men are warlords, not monarchs, and though elsewise much different one from the other, each has led his peoples against the wall, in hopes of breaching it and conquering the Seven Kingdoms to the south. The first king beyond the wall, according to legend, was Joramun, who claimed to have a horn that would bring down the wall when it woke the giants from the earth. That the wall still stands says something of his claim, and perhaps even of his existence.
Hardhome was once the only settlement approaching a town in the lands beyond the wall, sheltered on Storrel's Point and commanding a deep-water harbour. But 600 years ago, it was burned and its people destroyed, though the watch cannot say for a certainty what happened. Some say that cannibals from Skagos fell on them, others that slavers from across the narrow sea were at fault. The strangest stories, from a ship of the watch sent to investigate, tell of hideous screams echoing down from the cliffs above Hardhome, where no living man or woman could be found. A most fascinating account of Hardhome can be found in Maester Willis's Hardhome, an account of 3 years spent beyond the wall among savages, raiders, and woods witches. Willis journeyed to Hardhome on a Pentoshi trader, and established himself there as a healer and counselor, so that he might write of their customs. He was given the protection of Gorm the Wolf, a chieftain who shared control of Hardhome with 3 other chiefs. When Gorm was murdered in a drunken brawl, however, Willis found himself in mortal danger and made his way back to Old Town. There he set down his account, only to vanish the year after the illuminations were done. It was said in the Citadel that he was last seen at the docks, looking for a ship that would take him to Eastwatch by the sea.
The brothers Gendel and Gorn were joint kings 3,000 years ago, leading their hosts down beneath the earth into a labyrinth of twisting subterranean caverns. They passed beneath the wall unseen to attack the north. Gorn slew the Stark King in battle, then was killed in turn by the king's heir, and Gendel and his remaining wildlings fled back to their caverns, never to be seen again.
Among the wildlings, it is said that Gendel and his people became lost and trapped in the caverns, and still wander there today. Among the histories of the rangers, however, it is said that Gendel was slain as well, and that only a handful of his followers lived to flee back into the ground.
The Horn Lord would follow them 1,000 years after, or perhaps 2. His name is lost to history, but he was said to have used sorcery to pass the wall. After him, centuries later, came Bael the Bard, whose songs are still sung beyond the wall. But there are questions as to whether he truly existed or not. The wildlings say he did, and credit many songs to his name. But the old chronicles of Winterfell say nothing of him. Whether this was due to the defeats and humiliations he was said to have visited upon them, including, according to one improbable story, deflowering a Stark maid and getting her with child, or because he never existed, we cannot truly say. The last king beyond the wall to cross the wall was Raymond Redbeard, who brought the wildlings together in 212 or 213 AC. It was not until 226 AC that he and the wildlings would breach the wall by climbing in their hundreds and thousands up the slick ice and down the other side. Raymond's host numbered in the thousands, by all accounts, and they fought their way as far south as Long Lake. There Lord William Stark and the drunken giant, Lord Harmond of House Umber, brought their armies against them. With 2 hosts surrounding him and the lake to his back, Redbeard fought and died, but not before slaying Lord Willem. When the Night's Watch appeared at last, led by its Lord Commander, Jack Musgood, called Jolly Jack Musgood before the invasion, and Sleepy Jack Musgood forever after, the battle was done, and the angry Artus Stark, the late Lord Willem's brother, accounted the most fearsome warrior of his age, gave the Black Brothers the duty of burying the dead. This task, at the least, they performed admirably. The Riverlands. Much history, rife with both glory and tragedy, has been made in the lands watered by the River Trident and its 3 great vassal streams. Stretching from the Neck to the banks of the Blackwater and east to the borders of the Vale, the Riverlands are the beating heart of Westeros, No other land in the Seven Kingdoms has seen so many battles, nor so many petty kings and royal houses rising and falling. The causes of this are clear. Rich and fertile, the riverlands border on every other realm in the Seven Kingdoms save Dawn, yet have few natural boundaries to deter invasion. The waters of the Trident make the lands ripe for settlement, farming, and conquest, whilst the river's three branches stimulate trade and travel during peacetime, and serve as both roads and barriers in times of war.
The importance of the Trident to the region was never made clearer than when King Harwin Hoare, the grandfather of Harren the Black, fought over the riverlands with the Storm King Eric. The ironborn reavers were able to achieve dominance on the rivers and use them as a means to transport forces swiftly between far-flung strongholds and battlefields. The Storm King suffered his worst defeat at the crossing of the Blue Fork near Fairmarket, where the longships proved decisive in allowing the ironborn to seize the crossing, despite Eric's superior numbers.
The three branches of the Trident give the riverlands their name, the Red Fork, coloured by the mud and silt that tumbles down from the western mountains, the Green Fork, whose mossy waters emerge from the swamps of the neck, and the Blue Fork, named for the purity of its sparkling, spring-fed flow. Their wide waters are the roads by which goods pass through the riverlands, and it is not unknown to see lines of pole boats stretching a mile or more. There has never been a city in the riverland, strange as it may seem, though large market towns are common, likely because of the fractious history of the region, and a tendency for the kings of the past to refuse the charters that might have given some salt pans, or Lord Harroway's town, or Fair Market leave to expand. During the long centuries when the first men reigned supreme in Westeros, countless petty kingdoms rose and fell in the riverlands, their histories entwined and embroidered with myth and song, are largely forgotten, save for the names of a few legendary kings and heroes whose deeds are recorded on weathered stones in runes, whose meanings are even now disputed at the Citadel. Thus, while singers and storytellers may regale us with colourful tales of Artus the Strong, Florian the Fool, Nine-Finger Jack, Shara the Witch Queen, and the Green King of the God's Eye, the very existence of such personages must be questioned by the serious scholar. The true history of the Riverlands begins with the coming of the Andals. After crossing the Narrow Sea and sweeping over the Vale, these conquerors from the east moved to make it their own, sailing their longships up the Trident and its three great branches. In those days, it seems, the Andals fought in bands behind chieftains, whom the later Septons would name kings. Piece by piece, they encroached upon the many petty kings whose realms the rivers watered. Songs speak to us, through the years, of the fall of Maidenpool and the death of its boy king Florian the Brave, fifth of that name, of the Widow's Ford, where three sons of Lord Darry held back the Andal warlord, Vorian Vipran, and his knights for a day and a night, slaying hundreds before they fell themselves, of the Night in the White Wood, where supposedly the children of the forest emerged from beneath a hollow hill to send hundreds of wolves against an Andal camp, tearing hundreds of men apart beneath the light of a crescent moon, of the great battle of Bitter River, where the Brackens of Stonehenge and the Blackwoods of Raventree Hall made common cause against the invaders, only to be shattered by the charge of 777 Andal knights and seven septons, bearing the seven-pointed star of the faith upon their shields. The seven-pointed star went everywhere the Andals went, borne before them on shields and banners, embroidered on their surcoats, sometimes incised into their very flesh. In their zeal for the seven, the conquerors looked upon the old gods of the first men and the children of the forest as little more than demons, and fell upon the weirwood groves